This is the Future of Law podcast, where we explore what it means to be a lawyer and law firm of the future. I'm Judas from Australia.
And I'm Tessa from Canada. We are two entrepreneurs working on each edge of the planet, bringing you a platform to explore what the future holds for the legal industry. Hello, Kudus.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good. Over here in Australia, it's morning. What time is it there?
Evening here. It's actually 9:15 p.m.
Wow.
We are extremely motivated to bring the future of the podcast to all of you.
That's it.
And what about in Australia?
Oh, we're definitely motivated here. Don't worry. That's it's a beautiful day. It's a morning. It's a 10:45 here in the morning.
Right. Fantastic. So we have actually a new theme which we suggest to be discussing, Kudus and I.
Yeah, we haven't had a typical episode for a while now. We've recorded a few interviews and an interesting new type of episode that we'll release soon, hopefully. If not, it might have already come out actually, but our Kaleidoscope episode. Yeah,
it has.
on the schedule. No, it's good. So it's good back to original format and explore some ideas with you, Tessa, this week.
So, yes, we are actually going to discuss today a topic which is related to timing in innovation.
Mm.
So, action, and what is the cost of not taking action? When is the right time to innovate? You know, all of those questions that we tend to ask ourselves, and I'm sure Kudus, you also have, you know, heard many people in the legal industry asking you those questions in discussions.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't hear them asking that question. I generally see them not taking action.
Yes, that is true. We see some action, but we potentially could see more, right?
Of course, always. And I think it's important to actually speak to that theme today, you know, to actually explore what is the cost of not taking action and what maybe it will lead to a conversation of then how would we begin. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's start with when we take action and the cost of not taking action.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So, well, actually, I have a couple of things to say about when to take action and the cost of taking action. I've got a few ideas that I would love to share with you. And so I believe, and it's not just me believing it, it's more I drive those insights from other industries, given in the legal field, we might not have as many examples of innovative law firms that are taking bold actions and what's happening when this happens and what's the cost for the others. We don't yet see that because we don't yet have major disruptors in the legal industry, but we do have in other industries. And
well, I think to be fair, we have some. We have some that are coming along, but perhaps they haven't hit the character. They haven't hit the particular milestones that you might identify in these examples.
Yes,
we can look at it later.
Yes, I agree, and I would love for you to share more about, you know, the ones you have in mind. But I'm thinking about disruptors such as Apple and Amazon,
which were
major innovations that were extremely innovative, that they became disruptive. So the cost for competitors not to take action is pretty obvious. I mean, Nokia for cell phones, you know, well, it's not really the greatest example of a success story of not taking action. Or it did take action, but it took action in a way that did not lead the company to be as thriving as Apple today with the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason for that is, well, it's pretty simple, actually, when you look at the history. Mm-hmm. And so I would love to take that as an example. in order to illustrate my idea.
Let's go. Let's get into it.
Great. So at the time, Nokia was, I believe, the only one on the market. It was probably the first, actually, in the market. So in the beginning, it was very innovative, right? To bring the cell phone.
Yes.
I mean, it was extremely innovative at the time.
Shout out to Nokia 5110.
Yes. I do remember when I was young, to me, like, it was like, it was weird to see that thing, you know? It was extremely expensive at the time as well. And so eventually Nokia decided to improve the product. And how did Nokia improve the product? What did it do to improve it, the cell phone? Well, it made it smaller.
Yes. It tried thinner, lighter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And larger feature set. Mm-hmm. Color screens went from black, you know, went from that classic two-tone color to color.
Yeah, full and color. It used to have a long antenna as well, and eventually the antenna got, they got rid of the antenna.
Internal.
Or internal, exactly, correct. And some, you know, some would have the clipper, so you would hide the touch tones, right? You wouldn't see the keyboard, you know, because there would be sort of a clap as well.
Yes.
And so it made us cell phones, you know, smaller and lighter and everything that you said. And well, what happened afterwards is that we have the disruptor company that was working secretly on a completely different product that came out with no keyboards at all and in a completely different format. And and so then what happened? What happened is this company is Apple. We all know it's Apple, and they released this phone. And then what happened is Apple, they went to customers, and they, because they don't know at the beginning, Apple didn't fully knew what it was creating. It was creating something completely new, completely with a new design, a new shape, a new form.
Mm-hmm.
And it went to customers, potential customers, and it asked customers, so how much would you pay for this? You know? What do you think it's worth? And customers looked at the product and they say, oh, well, it's like a mini computer. So probably the price of a computer. Maybe even more. It actually fits in my pocket, you know? And this is how Apple got to sell the iPhone as a computer at the price, about the same price as a computer.
Okay.
And eventually Nokia slowly fade out because it became entirely obsolete, given it was not delivering. It didn't have the power of an iPhone.
Mm.
And so what I'm trying to say by sharing this story, and I would love to hear your insights as well, but maybe let me just finish on that comment, is that actually by trying to innovate by doing the same thing better, so by Nokia trying to do the cell phone better, well, they got disrupted because there is another company on the same market that decided to do entirely new things that made the old things completely obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the risk in the legal field of not taking action, that eventually someone, maybe this someone is already on the market, whether it's out or secretly in the market,
right,
you know, building new things, and it's going to make the way we deliver legal services today completely obsolete. And once this is going to happen, this is going to be extremely, extremely dramatic, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I would say that this is happening. It hasn't taken the hold. It hasn't taken hold, and there hasn't been a single sort of identifiable mainstream brand or company that's taken over, right? So we're not at the stage where we're looking at a Google or an Apple. But what happens in the early stages is, you know, Apple wasn't the only player in the market. You know, there are other people that were in the market and that were doing new things. And I think in parallel to what's happening in parallel to your example, what's happening here is actually you have quite a number of people, companies, legal tech or law companies or legal service providers that are all actually asking that question and are all trying to implement something. So here it's interesting because that consequence that you're talking about for not taking action, it's already begun. It's just a matter of time now between who actually is able to dominate market, even if that's, you know, a desired outcome or not. You know, the reality is there's a lot more complexity, but in the law, that is to say, between, you know, or if you want to compare it to like a phone did one or two things. Now it does more things. We are going sort of the other way. The law does many things, and its solutions are going to, you know, there's a lot more opportunity to disrupt that, the solutions, right? Mm-hmm. They can become some of the elements can become simplified. Maybe the entire thing can become simplified, but mm-hmm. but the reality is we're going from complex, starting from complex to potentially simple, or complex to complex but streamlined. Mm-hmm. Whereas the phone example was an expansion of something very simple to something mm-hmm. very complex.
Well, it's something very complex, but as is that is available in a very simple format as well. And this is why this product is so appreciated by customers,
right.
Because
exactly.
it's extremely easy to use. And yes. so the complexity is not even seen or felt by the users of the product. So I think right. this is where the magic is. That it's
so it could be reversed then. Mm-hmm. It could go from complex to simple, which is the reverse of what's potentially happened there. Mm-hmm. But it's remained, I guess I mean in terms of the, you know, the actual iteration of hardware and what's happening under the hood has become more complex. You're right. The actual end user experience is simple, but it is expanded, right? Because the initial frame of mind for a phone user who had a Nokia 5110 was you pick up the phone, you press the unlock button, you put a code in if you have one, and then you dial a number and you make a phone call, or you send a text, or you mm-hmm. play Snake. And that's really all about. That's really all that there was.
That's what you were doing, right?
Right. But now the framework, is well, yeah. At that age, I was just grabbing my dad's phone and playing Snake. But now that the new framework is, we have an ecosystem, we have a palette, you know, a screen space that we now fill with apps, and you can choose what apps exist on them. You can, you know, the baseline apps that come, yes, you write messages in a more complex way. Yes, you make phone calls in a more sophisticated way. But now you can do a bunch of other things as well. Mm-hmm. You can surf the internet. You can listen to music. You know, these were the original sort of mm-hmm. added features that were there. So I do believe that even though the process may be simple, the frame of mind of the user became more complex because they could do a whole bunch more mm-hmm. now on that single device. So
mm-hmm. it's interesting yeah. because in the law, I like the way you put it, is that we are doing things that are extremely complex in law. We're doing a lot of things. There's a lot of diversity. Mm. And the range is very broad. And maybe it's time also to sort of narrow it down so we can start innovating on maybe some smaller errors of law. So by segmenting it and narrowing it down, it's going to be easier to create this experience that is still going to be vast, but into a certain extent, it's going to be, you know, as not as broad as it is today, and maybe hopefully easier for the user.
Simplified and streamlined, but it's still a complex framework, right? We're mm-hmm. coming from somewhere where there is, you know, a lawyer's mind or you know, someone who works in and around the law. The framework with which they approach everything is actually quite complex. There's a lot of things to consider, different areas of law, case law, statute, you know, and then, you know, all of the skills required to mm-hmm. to carry out, you know,
I agree.
Justice. So yeah, mm-hmm. go on.
Maybe because in law, we are so used to look in the past for answers that we're not able to seek for new possibilities in the future. And I believe this is becoming a major challenge now, as by looking towards the past, what I see happening in the legal field now in terms of mostly law firms and the traditional law firms is that all of the action that are taken, or maybe most of them at least, are made to protect the status quo, because the model has been extremely successful in this part in the past, and to some extent it is still very successful, right? Because if it was not, we would see a completely different dynamic, but it still is successful, right?
It is, but that's the thing, right? It's a question of if new is already happening, it's just a matter of time. So we could say some are late, but late is better than never, because never means obsolete potentially, right? And
yes,
and that's probably what we both agree on, that the obsoleteness will happen and come if we don't take some action, even if we are late to the table. Late is better than never.
Exactly. So probably we are late on schedule already, given, at least if we compare with other industries and in terms of the digital transformation and the integration and adoption of technology, the legal field is fairly late. And in the market, if we just look at the market, on the legal market, well, we, as you said, Kudus, there are some innovative law firms. There are some new law type of firms that emerge that are gaining momentum. They are gaining attention. They are growing, and some are growing quite fast. Yes. So,
well, there are also, there's the new law model, right? That's one thing that's been coined as a phrase that has a specific type of situation. Or characteristics, but there's also legal service providers that probably sit outside of that sort of classical partnership. The law companies, their structures are completely different. They have a completely different philosophy to approaching how to solve, legal issues, and are built from the ground up using technology, streamlining and automating as much as possible. What was initially and originally a human services sort of, 1 hour input, 1 hour output situation. It's not just new law. You have law companies now, I think, or legal tech companies that are so integrated or partnered really well with more traditional law firms, or even, for instance, I think a good example an example that I've seen is, I believe it's called Atrium. So they're trying to run, they have lawyers on staff, but I think they have a complete tech approach to seeing how they can actually streamline the entire process from start to finish. And as they take on work and solve those problems, they will learn the patterns that they need to learn in order to, lock down the process into something that they can actually say with high confidence has cut a lot of the time, has increased the efficiency. And it just looks different, right? It just looks completely different. So, yeah, I think that there's a distinction between, old law, new law, and then there's another whole aspect of a law company or legal tech.
And potentially companies. Those are the disruptors. They are potentially the ones that are going to be making the old law obsolete. More likely than the new law companies, law firms, right?
Yes. I think I feel that it's an intermediary step. I think there will still be relevance for new law model. It's a way of thinking that's changed, but then the pace of change has happened so rapidly that there are companies that are probably 4 or 5 steps ahead at just thinking of it, thinking from ground zero, thinking of it completely differently. And approaching it differently, and as those succeed in bridging between what's happening right now and what they think will be happening, and the way that they're building it from scratch with that in mind, you will start to see, I guess, a dominant player emerge, or dominant players emerge.
Eventually, there will very likely be one or at least a few dominant players. And correct. I'm referring especially to the blockchain technology to be very practical and concrete. Mm-hmm. I believe that the blockchain technology is potentially even more disruptive than artificial intelligence. And the reason for that is because in the law, we have usually notaries and also lawyers working, at, the chain of contracts and mm-hmm. retracing, the history and making sure everything is authentic, mm-hmm. and blockchain potentially can completely disrupt that
entire process. Yeah.
Yes, with the only use of this technology. Yes. And
well, blockchain comes in at the level of infrastructure, right? In the same way that, I guess an example I could give to explain what I'm saying is like where Google is infrastructure for search and infrastructure for mail for a lot of people, right? Blockchain mm-hmm. becomes infrastructure for you to build whatever you want on top of it and be able to just, it's the go-to technology for, traceability, accountability, transparency, chain, supply chain. There are so many applications for it, but it's seen as an infrastructure, as in a lot of an entire world will be built on top of it. And distributed mm-hmm. internet, distributed systems will all benefit from that, that foundation of blockchain. So,
and the ones who will be able to use blockchain wisely and in a smart way, very likely are going to be extremely ahead of all of the competitors. And why is that? Is because I am drawing that insight from the Blue Ocean Strategy from the Harvard School mm-hmm. that is telling us, at some point in the market, you have, it can be a new player in the market. It can be someone who's been in the market before that is going to create a new product that is like, it's not even a new product. It's actually creating a new market space. It's by delivering a product that is so different from what was done before that it actually makes everything that was done before irrelevant. And it's creating a new demand by creating a new market space. And with this new market space that it is actually creating it, itself. So the new player or the old player is creating this new market and is the only one on the new market. Right. And then you have a huge compelling advantage because that's you it. Master the game. You have all the cards in your hand.
Yes.
Yeah. And
market grows, you grow as the dominant player. It's also Peter Thiel's
philosophy of 0 to 1, right?
Yeah, it's Peter Thiel's philosophy of 0 to 1 as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar. I guess Peter Thiel's philosophy is also an adaptation of the Blue Ocean Strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So
the infrastructure that you mentioned, which is the blockchain,
it can't. Well, it will be one of them, right? I think it will there be may one be others, of them. But it is one of the. There's no question about how big of a role it plays.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And so this is how when a player is going to figure out how to use blockchain in a very smart way with a user-friendly approach, then there's going to be a huge cost for all of those who have not yet taken action. And what I mean is, by taking action, it's not necessarily that everybody needs to explore the blockchain, because this is sometimes what I hear and what I see. Mm. Oh, we all need to develop AI and we all need to investigate blockchain technology as a potential for us to transform the way we work. And I don't believe that all and every one of the players today in the legal industry need to develop AI or need to work using blockchain.
Correct.
But instead, you agree with me, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Instead, what I see personally, and I look forward to hear what you see, Kudus, but I see more like some law firms building not just technological skills, but taking action by building human skills. And this is where it gets really fascinating, because the technology is going to allow us to spend more time, you know, doing human related tasks, you know, such as building strategy, conversing like we're conversing now,
yes,
and brainstorming.
Yes.
Solving problems. And the technology is likely not going to do that. At least not in the years to come.
And even if they could, the question is, you know, the current question is, do we want that? You know, that's really the question that's put in the AI space is do we want to secede our human autonomy to an artificial autonomy or artificial intelligence, human intelligence to artificial intelligence? There are benefits, but there are also very much, you know, pitfalls that if we're not careful, some decisions that should be left to humans will be made by non-humans for humans. And we're seeing examples of that going wrong as well as we try to figure that out in the world. So yeah, I agree with what you're saying. It is going to be a renaissance. It is supposed to be, I think, a renaissance, right? It's going where people are, you know, sometimes I hear this, you know, the fear is stemmed from, oh, these things are taking our jobs. We used to be able to bill for this. Now we can't bill for it. How do we move into this new market? How do we structure our, you know, revenue models and financial models for being able to deal with the fact that before we would bill for time and now we're making it faster. So are we working ourselves out of a job? No, I think there's a healthy balance. I think you take advantage of the technology that's been used to automate, streamline, and cut down the hours. And you change your models. And what you do focus on is how to make it a better human experience. And the biggest challenge for law firms is the reputation of lawyers. You know, mm-hmm. It's the fact that we need to be seen as people that do what we actually do. We believe that we, you know, are there to serve society, but we're definitely not seen that way.
I agree. You know, by and large. I agree that the human reputation is exactly. extremely important. Exactly. And so this is even it's an extremely valuable reason for law firms to also invest in the human abilities of the staff. So
And the only way you're going to create more time is by leveraging the new technology that's there to be able to streamline what would take 10 hours to take 1 hour. You're left with those 9 hours. That's not money taken away. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to understand. It's opportunity given to actually create a better service.
I agree. And it's extremely interesting to see how we are moving into this conversation of innovation and timing, because I believe we can have extremely slow innovation that are more related to building human skills. As we know, building human skills takes time.
Time, yes. Behavioral change takes time.
Behavioral change is tough. And personal development is something that, you know, is an everyday work. And I believe that we will see some law firms that might be considered as slow innovators, but that will be extremely successful in the future because they are making the wise decision today to not necessarily invest in technology, but let others do the technological development and invest instead in human abilities, in human, to invest in the human power, right?
Well, the way I agree, the way I would say it would be to invest in the marriage between the technology that is coming into play and exists now with the human aspect. It's a marriage between the two, right? It's not a pure focus on human, although that is critical. I agree, it's critical. But the wise decision will be how best to marry the balance between the two, because that's exactly what it's going to be. It's going to be a balance between the two. It's not going to be a takeover. As the technological capacity expands, it doesn't chew into what the human aspect of it is, but there needs to be time spent on what is the actual human aspect of it. We need to rethink that, and we need to understand it in harmony, in coherence, in unison with the technology that grows as well, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's giving us opportunities. But it's funny, it's so funny, Tessa, the way that we talk about this, and where we started this conversation, there should be no doubt that that change is happening. You know,
the change
just,
is happening. It makes it so
sometimes so silly to think that there that people still are feeling like
we're
not questioning that
change is not happening. We're saying, well, how do you embrace the change? When do you get started? So how long can you wait before you get started?
Well, exactly, and I think we've sort of agreed that we're establishing that it's already late. But it's better than never, right?
Exactly. That's what I say to my friends when I show up late for an appointment. I say, well, so I guess that applies to law firms. If you're a little bit late with your customers, well, yeah. I guess that would apply too, right?
Yeah, I'll try that one next time and see how it goes. I'll let you know.
I'm not sure it's a good strategy, but yeah.
No, it's fine. So I wanted to ask, let's get into some practicals. What are the first three things that would stop someone from change in terms of innovation?
Whoa, that is an interesting and difficult question, Kudos.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the first reasons, and I think I briefly mentioned it, is that we tend to protect the status quo too much.
Okay.
Because we benefit from the status quo in the market. Right. We do. Right.
It
would be too hard to change and the models still work. So let's keep doing it.
Right. Okay. That's clear. I don't really think we need to talk about that even more.
All right. So
I think everyone that's listening is probably very familiar with that conversation.
So what else is preventing us from changing? I mean, I don't see any other argument than the fact that we don't have any incentive that are strong enough to make us change. But is there something else?
Well, I think the way you've said the second time around is actually slightly different, right? Is there not enough strong enough incentive? I think there is, but perhaps fear of change or the I guess it's related, right? Being uncomfortable with change and being comfortable with the status quo are the same thing said in two different ways. It's interesting. What would the other three things? I'm trying to think. What would the other two things be? So first status quo is comfortable.
Status quo is very comfortable. And I think the other thing is we don't have a methodology to change. So we don't know how to change.
Right.
As I actually just said today on one of my LinkedIn posts that innovation is like climbing a mountain. Mm. You don't know how you're going to climb the mountain. You never know. Even if you are
predefined.
If you're extremely experienced at climbing, so you don't know exactly how you're gonna climb a specific mountain.
Yes.
Even if you've done it several times, actually. Yes. But eventually you make it.
Yes.
You find your way through it and you make it and you go up there and you're extremely happy and proud and satisfied that you made it, but you don't really know how you made it. But you do know how you made it because you have experience and someone taught you how to climb. So you have got basic techniques and you have someone that usually, you know, is providing some safety for you. So if you ever fail, you know, someone is here to have you back.
Yes.
So I think if we can bring a methodology.
Yes. Well, to give your example, right, a good climber is not because they've memorized the path. A good climber is they have a set of skills that they have, you know, made very sharp, you know, in their sharp tools, but part of their approach is elastic, right? They take whatever comes. They're able to make sense of a random set of events ahead of them, you know, a random rock pattern, a random formation that they need to climb. It's not that they've predefined it and memorized it and they just rinse and repeat. Their strength and experience and advancement, you know, is shown through the fact that they're in their agility to respond to whatever is just above them, right?
I think the agility part is extremely important. And I really like that you bring that up into the conversation because I mean, I'm sure everybody knows that I'm very much into design thinking and legal design, and it's an other form or almost another name to simplify of agile philosophy, right?
Right.
And being agile as a company is having this capacity to adjust very quickly to their circumstances. Mm. So by being so agile, you actually make sure you are making the right move, but you don't necessarily know what is the right move in advance. And this is why we need, and again, I'm going to tell it again, we need a new kind of thinking. We cannot just apply linear thinking to innovation, right? We just can't.
So the second thing is a lack of a methodology, right? A lack of a framework to approach so that you can take on whatever comes as it comes, right? Because no one knows what it's going to be. Or there are some that can help you. But I think that leads to the third one, right? The third one is actually that lack of support, which is where I think both your work and my work directly become involved, where we recognize that in this changing sort of landscape, right, there is an entire area of work that can be dedicated. There is an entire market that can be dedicated to supporting transition, to supporting people, corporation, bodies of people, partnerships, groups of people into making those changes and developing a methodology and building capacity to think a certain way, to act a certain way, to strategize. You know, all of these things are, I think, that would be the third thing that's stopping people. Because once you come out of your comfort zone, that's the first one, right? That that's the first challenge, that status quo is comfortable. So you come out of it, you go, okay, I know I need to change. The next question you're going to ask is, how do we do it? And then the third question you'd ask is there anyone to help me do this? Is that fair?
I totally agree. And we need to have a methodology. We need to have a new mindset. We need to have support. And we need to stop holding the past as the one and only reality for our future.
Right.
And to move forward into the future, now it is time to believe that the future can actually be better than what it is now. Because what I feel in the industry right now is we actually fear that the future is going to be worse, because AI is going to disrupt, blockchain is going to disrupt as well. And what is going to be left for lawyers? And the fear of not being able to adjust is actually preventing us to move towards the future.
Mm.
I actually have shivers just saying that. But yeah. we need to be able to imagine that a new reality is possible.
Yes.
And we need to create it.
Yes.
So how can we find incentives now to our accelerators, our facilitators that will be able to sort of push for the future to come to us in the present time?
Mm. Well, first, I think we've explored maybe one that I could throw in the ring is one that we explored, I think, a few episodes ago, which is, type of leadership, someone who's willing to take those decisions, make those decisions and lead from that perspective. And it doesn't always mean the senior partner, it doesn't always mean the managing partner, although they will be very critical to this. But the combination of leaders, so whether a leader is a junior who's come in and has a great idea and wants to pursue that, that person is a leader and would need to lead that particular process, but also supported by other leaders within the organization, right? So given the resources, whatnot. Mm-hmm. So that's one accelerator, having the right type of leadership in place that is thinking that far ahead, that is understanding and willing and willing to take that on, right?
Yes, and actually, Cruz and I, we've talked about this in one of your previous episodes about, the role of a leader, the role of an innovator and a manager, and how the three can better work together in order to support innovation. So if you haven't listened to this episode, I strongly encourage you to go back after this episode, to go back to one of the previous ones so you can listen to it, because you will, I think it was one of the most successful so far. Like, the feedback was amazing. So I strongly encourage you to to listen to that about the leadership. Yeah. And I think leadership is extremely, you've said it very well, Kudus. I don't think I have anything to add to that. We know we need a new type of leadership. And for that to happen, I believe that we need also to train ourselves to be more imaginative in the way we're going to work with technology or without technology, as I previously mentioned. Like you might just want to focus on being a problem solver type of firm. And I'm sure many clients will be extremely happy to be able to use your brain and your strategies in order to prevent some disputes from happening and solve them in a more efficient way, because
reach better commercial outcomes. Because strategy is not just about avoiding dispute; it's also central to business success. You know, commercial success.
Being able to support your client in the entire life, whether they are businesses or individuals, and so this is great. This is fantastic.
So the second one, should we go to number two?
Yes. What would be number two?
I have a feeling. I think that the logical extension from what we've said, number one is a dedicated injection of funds. And I think it's a big question. I think there needs to be an allocation of not just funds. I guess what I'm trying to say is dedicated allocation of resources, because it's not just financial. There are human resources that need to be put aside for these things to happen. And that would accelerate it. So sometimes the idea isn't there, but I actually have a very strong feeling that even within your firm, there are probably a lot of ideas floating around. The issue is, you know, the thing that needs to be, that would help accelerate this process, is a vehicle for it to be funded, a vehicle for it to be explored and exploited, you know. So both from a finance perspective and from a human resources perspective, there needs to be a vehicle for your organization to be able to explore, exploit, you know, find the new thing and be able to spend money in doing that. Like, you know, be able to, because it can't be tested without that, right? You can't just model something or an idea without actually applying it in a commercial sense to see if it works. So all of those things need to happen. I think there needs to be an allocation.
Well, this is really interesting. I absolutely love your ideas. And
what do you think?
I'm so in agreement. I mean, how do we get those funds? Where are those funds?
Well, we have them. The point is that they're not dedicated. It's not dedicated in an allocated vehicle, right? With a clear, clear understanding from the people who are infusing it, the resources and the finances in that vehicle. There needs to be a clear dedication and also a clear policy set out for what that is for. But you know, if everyone agrees and understands, and, you know, this is common practice in businesses outside, you know, any business, there's almost like an 80-20 split. There should always be a nest egg of 20 that works on the next thing, you know, 20%, whether it's 20% finance or 20% human resources, that works on where the market might be moving, figuring out the next thing. Because if we become dependent, and this is the issue here, ultimately, we've become dependent on that status quo, become dependent on the way that, you know, client comes to us, we onboard them, we build them, we solve the problem, we build them the per hour and they pay it and that's it. That dependency is actually, you know, central to your downfall. Because what happens when that expectation changes? What happens when the market decides, oh, well, there's a better way to sort of retain legal advice and legal services, and more of us are going to realize that and go, hold on, someone else is doing it a lot better, a lot faster, a lot cheaper, and by cheaper I don't mean like low quality.
You mean like in the most cost-effective way.
Correct.
More efficient in terms of cost. Yeah. And so does this mean that
be an 80-20 split? I think that should be like at least a starting point. Or if it's too much to ask of the people who control the money in the organization, do a 90-10 split. You know, and but put some resources aside for figuring out where the market's moving and what needs to be done moving forward and trying those things out, you know.
And is one of the solution as to funding or one of the avenue to fund, would it be related to working in collaboration with startups, for instance? Could it be one of the way to use this funding?
It can be, and there are examples of firms that are larger and have more resources. Their one of their strategies has been to actually hold equity stakes in new law companies, you know, or new technologies. So if a startup is working on a new technology to have an equity stake or ownership, you know, or majority ownership in that company and actually fund the development of that technology. So yes, it is a possibility.
Interesting. And could it be the third accelerator for innovation startups? Do you think startups as
or to incubate?
Like yeah, internally? to incubate and to support as well more startups and entrepreneurs in order to allow them to bring those fresh ideas. That maybe, you know,
I agree. I would say it slightly differently, Tessa. Sorry to cut you off. I think it's exactly what you're saying, but the way I would say it is the third accelerator is to expand your network. So to actually go out and build partnerships, establish relationships with startups, with incubators, with people who are solely focused on those things, you know, with companies, with people such as yourself, you know, different people who are innovating, because that is ultimately one of the best ways to accelerate this process of change, because you're opening your eyes essentially by widening your network and seeking out people who are doing new things, seeking out people who are servicing the industry to change, you know, seeking out people who are making incubating ideas or investing in ideas. You start to understand where that's going to accelerate it, because now you have flags, right? Now you have milestones. Now you have examples in the market of what you initially believed didn't exist. You know what I mean?
Interesting. Like, yes, I do. I know exactly what you mean. And because just to clarify as well, do you mean like building partnerships possibly with other professionals that are not lawyers? So, for instance, accountants, psychologists, ethnologists, sociologists. Yes.
These are good examples. The reason I'm keeping it very top line is because it is truly that open. So I like to keep it at just expanding your network to see what is new happening. What new is happening? It can be inside the industry. It can be outside the industry, right? But but I think it's a healthy combination of both. And obviously, the wider the net is cast in terms of a network, and it doesn't necessarily mean partnership with all of these different people, but by expanding it, getting involved in those spaces, getting involved in those conversations, whether they happen at a symposium, whether they happen in a local restaurant or a pub.
And talking about restaurants and maybe shopping malls, it reminds me of a very practical example of an innovative law firm in Ontario, which is in big province in Canada, where we have those kind of law firm shops that are right next to Walmarts. Maybe you have that as well in Australia, in other jurisdictions.
Okay.
So those cheap shopping malls where people go to buy, you know, like discounted food and appliances for home. Well, there is this law firm that has a shop right at the entrance, you know.
Right.
And so they sell cheap, affordable, easy, you know, fairly simple legal, mostly documents or easy to deliver services, you know, pretty straightforward. Right. And so is this an example of how you can expand your network? It can be.
But that also, that is probably more about the second accelerator, which is allocating resources, because they've gone ahead and actually rented brick and mortar location. That's quite a commitment at that point. I think expanding your network can be a lot less onerous. It is an involvement of time rather than a pure allocation of time and money and resources and, you know, purchasing or renting property and moving people into it. I think the network is about being involved in that conversation constantly, being involved in the wider conversation, contributing to it, being involved in a growing community so that you can see what is starting to happen, so that, it, you know, again, it's way beyond the question of is change happening. You know, there's no doubt about that. But now you're actually, by expanding your network and accelerating these things, you are accelerating your ability to change, because you are part of that stream of conversation that's happening. And within that, you'll find the nuances you need. And within that, eventually, you'll find the partners that you may want to have and the solutions that you may be looking at in the short, midterm, and long future.
Mm-hmm. So it could be as well a way to expand your network in the digital world, which is something I love, to expand 100%. Your network online.
That would be, because that, it's, yeah, of course. Yeah,
it's as you say, you don't need to invest. Exactly. You don't need to invest in brick and mortar. You can just be online and interact and build. And what I really, really love about your idea and taking the network strategy online instead of in the physical world, as we tend to think, because this is what we've been used to do, and this is what we've seen in the past. But taking that online, what I really love about your idea is that you can add what we know as exponential strategies. You may have heard me say about talk about exponential strategies, but basically exponential strategies is that you leverage technology to a level that is actually mind-blowing, literally, because it allows you to expand your network and expand your growth and your reach and your impact in an exponential way. And literally, you can serve maybe not billions, but you can serve millions of customers by using those strategies and expanding your network, as you say.
Yes. Well, look, I wouldn't even shy away from saying billions, because that's exactly what the Google of our industry will do. That's how they become the dominant player. So it is a question of scale. It is a question of exponential growth and exponential strategies. I think we covered it.
I think we were a really good team, because I was...
High five.
Virtual high five. I mean, really, like, you were so good on the accelerators. You really nailed it. And I was more into the resistance, you know? I was more into what's holding us from moving forward. And you were like, all right, so now this is what we need. 1, 2, 3, let's do it. This is what we need to move forward.
You got me fired up. So I had to, you know, I was on a roll. So, and I think I chewed up a lot of the talk time. So I apologize to the listeners and you for if you're hearing too much of my voice, you know.
We love to have, you know, if we want even more. We've been talking quite a lot today. So we really hope you got a lot of value out of this episode. And then you're going to be considering as well, you know, about when is a good time to change and how do you want to change. And I'm quite confident you will be able to think about some of the ideas we brought to you today. And we look forward to hear how you will be doing with your innovation timing, whether you want to sprint or you want to be running a marathon. It's a matter for you to choose your style, but once you have a vision, it's much easier than to decide how you want to run this innovation race.
Yes, thank you for listening, everyone, and thank you, Tessa, for having this conversation with me.
Thank you so much, Kudos. Always a pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you again on the other edge of the planet.
Yes.
It was about, 10 to 11 hours difference.
Yeah. And
you morning, need to evenings. Sleep. Yeah, time to sleep for me now. All right.
All right, thanks, everyone.
Have a beautiful day, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. If this episode resonates with you, we'd love for you to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your colleagues and friends. Follow and leave your feedback on Twitter. And like us on Facebook.
You can connect with Tessa and myself on LinkedIn, Twitter, and you can also visit our websites, futurelab.legal and legalcreatives.com. How do you know, man?